My dear welfarers, I got it right this year. When Brother Shepherd wrote to me and suggested this study, I'm quite sure I didn't know what I was letting myself in for. I'm sure he knew a lot more about the book of Zechariah than I did, which is probably why he'd asked me to do something about it. But anyway, when I began to read through it, I realized just how difficult some of it was, for a lot of what I shall have to say will be rather tentative. Don't let this worry you. I think that's far more preferable than picking out some interpretation that you think is right for no other reason than it merely appeals to you, and then dogmatizing and saying that must be the one. Some of you will have other ideas. My guess, your guess, will be as good as mine, and sometimes a good deal better. But we'll come to that later. Now, the historical period has been well outlined by Brother Mason, and especially in the preparation of this visual chart here, which gives us the salient period, salient points of the period with which we are dealing. Now, about the general background, I don't want to say anything at all. I want to go straight into the prophecy of Zechariah. Now, the name of the prophet is significant, and it is one of the names in the Old Testament on which we can dogmatize about its meaning. We do know what it means. It means Yahweh remembers. In fact, it occurs quite a lot in the Bible of the remembering of the Lord of various things. And this is what the name means. And the introduction to the book is rendered the more fitting because, as Brother Mason has mentioned when he touched on these six verses of the first chapter of Zechariah, he appeals to past experience and the result of the disregard of the people for the former prophets. And the lesson that he seeks to draw runs much deeper than the establishment of a mere historical parallel between past and present situations. He puts his finger in these six verses unerringly on the prevailing weakness of this period after the exile. It's also not without significance that a number of phrases throughout the book again and again recall the prophecy of Jeremiah. For the people had learned little from the exile. They had learned little from the work of Jeremiah, who had tried to teach them that religion was primarily an affair of the spirit, that God's covenant was ultimately to be graven upon the heart and not upon tables of stone, and did not depend upon the externals of religion. And the people had not grasped the significance of what Jeremiah had said and done. They had not really understood why they had been carried away captive into Babylon. They were merely concerned about putting the clock back without learning anything of the lessons. The most that they could aspire to do was a restoration of the mechanical ritual of the law, and even that was half-hearted, rather than a truly spiritual turning again to God, a true renewal of the covenant on an individual basis, an appreciation of why God had been displeased with their fathers, why they had been carried away captive, and a determination to, in the grace of God, not repeat the mistakes of their fathers. And so Zechariah appeals for true repentance, for right conduct, for fellowship with God, for all the things that really constitute religion and what that means in the Bible, rather than the performance of some mechanical ritual which they felt put them in the right relationship to God, irrespective of their own conduct and their attitude to it. So how well he introduces his prophecy with these ideas. And then, having said this, he launches into a series of eight visions. We'll have to consider these. My original intention had been to consider the salient ideas of the prophecy of Zechariah, rather than take it as a chapter-by-chapter basis. But wherever we turn, we find that there are difficulties of interpretation, and this particular approach becomes impossible. We've got to face up to the problem of the eight visions and tackle them one at a time. And the first is recorded in chapter 1, from verse 7 onwards. I don't intend to read the whole passage. You can let your eye run down this if you haven't already read through it before this weekend in preparation for our study. Now, we're told at the beginning that upon the 24th day of the month, the word of the Lord came to Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo, the prophet, saying, I saw by night, and behold, a man riding upon a red horse, and he stood among the myrtle trees that were in the bottom, and behind him there were red horses, speckled and white. Now, he saw these visions by night, we're told. Some have suggested that these visions are dreams that were given to Zechariah. Others have argued that this is a special condition which is produced by the Holy Spirit. Yet others have said that this is a mere literary form in which the prophet clothed his ideas. It's a technical point of some interest, but not of any considerable importance, I feel, as we are unlikely to ever fully understand the processes of inspiration. Now he sees this rider upon the red horse, standing among the myrtle trees, with horses behind him of various colours, standing, he puts it, in the bottom. This is better translated, a hollow place where myrtles grow. Apparently, the myrtle tree grows in low-lying areas. And some have suggested that this particular picture was suggested to the prophet's mind by an actual place, by the valley of the Kidron at its junction with the valley of Hinnom. And for this there are a variety of reasons. In the first place, the spot is the lowest near the city of Jerusalem and the most likely to be that which is known as the Hollow. And secondly, it has always been a garden, being referred to as the King's Garden in the second book of Kings. And there is some reason for believing in the last vision in chapter 6. The scene is set in the same place as the first, and no other locality near Jerusalem would so well suit both cases. So it's quite likely that he has in mind an actual place, even though this is a vision, and the place is somewhere just outside Jerusalem, the valley of Kidron. Now, some have argued for the separate identity of the man who rides upon the red horse, the group, amongst the group of horses in the hollow place where the myrtle trees grow, and the angel that talked with Zechariah, and the angel that stood among the myrtle trees. Some have argued that there are three quite separate ideas, quite separate persons. Indeed, one commentator that I read argued for some 10 or 12 pages that the man spoken of was the second person of the Trinity, which was a very remarkable idea, and that commentator didn't last very long on the shelves of the library. Now, the man and the angel amongst the myrtle trees are surely the same, because we have in verse 10, the man that stood among the myrtle trees answered and said, "These are they whom the Lord hath sent to walk to and fro through the earth." And they answered the angel of the Lord that stood among the myrtle trees and said, "We have walked to and fro through the earth, and behold, all the earth sitteth still and is at rest." There is therefore good reason for believing that this man is also an angel of the Lord. This seems a reasonable conclusion. Not two separate persons, but the same person. But this is not necessarily the same as the angel that talked with Zechariah. And here I think we must distinguish two angels: the angel of the vision and the angel who talks with Zechariah. We shall see later that there are two angels in one or two of the visions that Zechariah has. And we know from other prophecies of Scripture which are similar to this that there were two angels that appeared to the prophet. Daniel, for example, on several occasions had visions where there were quite definitely two angels involved. So it seems like then the man who rides upon the red horse is an angel of the Lord, and is not the same angel of the Lord who acts as the interpreter to Zechariah. Now, the horsemen, what are we going to make of them? Of verse 8. Are there four of them? Are there two red horses? One sorrel and one white? There aren't four colours, you know, there's only three colours. But are there two of the same colour? Well, if so, we have here an obvious parallel with the book of Revelation, with the famous four horsemen of the apocalypse, in the vision of the seals. Also, notice that we have the same sort of cry, "How long?" Verse 12. The angel of the Lord answered and said, "O Lord of hosts, how long wilt thou not have mercy on Jerusalem and on the cities of Judah, against which thou hast had indignation these 70 years? The same point is made in the book of Revelation, where the souls under the altar cry, "O Lord, how long, holy and true, wilt thou not avenge the blood of those who have been slain?" and so on. It seems fairly obvious that the passage in Revelation, the vision there, is modelled on this in Zechariah 1. But the parallel is not necessarily exact in every detail. For surely the book of Revelation presents a Christian interpretation of a similar vision to this, which depends mainly upon a Jewish interpretation. It seems more likely, however, that instead of four horsemen, there were three troops of horsemen, represented by the three colours that are mentioned here: the red, the sorrel, and the white. And here the horsemen are represented as being observers rather than agents of destruction. They don't ride forth to destroy, they ride forth to observe. And they report what they see back to the Lord, that the earth is quiet and is at rest. The messengers were dispatched together, and at the time of the vision they appear to have accomplished their mission. Now the implication is that the Gentile nations are at ease, whilst Judah is still troubled. Look at verse 15, where the angel of God speaking on the Lord's behalf says, I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. So Judah is still troubled, whilst the Gentiles are at rest. Now this makes it unlikely that the different colours of the horses represent a succession either of events or of empires. For quite a number of people who've tried to interpret the book of Zechariah have suggested that this group of three horses, or possibly four horsemen, represents a succession either of events or of the great empires of the ancient world. That seems unlikely. In verse 12, there's the appeal to God, how long? When are you going to have mercy on Jerusalem that has been the object of your indignation for these 70 years? Appropriately, this is asked by the angel of the Lord, who reappears in chapter 3 as the champion of Joshua when he represents the nation. Now, Brother Mason has already mentioned the fact that you can start your dates for the captivity from different points. If we start as our beginning of the captivity, the date when Nebuchadnezzar actually subdued Judah, we have the year 605 BC, and if we subtract 520 from this, the year that this vision was received by Zechariah, this is a period of 85 years. If, however, we start our calculations from the destruction of the temple in 586, then in 520 this is 66 years after. And it seems most likely that the former period is the one that the prophet has in mind. That is, that the temple has not yet been fully restored, even though it is some 85 years after the impious Nebuchadnezzar had captured the city. How long is God's indignation going to last? It's gone more than the 70 years. Seems to be the implication behind it anyway. And then verse 13, the Lord answered the angel that talked with me with good words and comfortable words. We're reminded of the message of Isaiah, comfort ye my people. And the message of comfort is given in the form that the angel who acts as the interpreter repeats them to Zechariah in verse 14. So the angel that communed with me said unto me, cry thou, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, I am jealous for Jerusalem and for Zion with a great jealousy. Now this word jealousy has been much misunderstood. In the Old Testament, this word jealousy implies a special interest on the part of one person for another. It presupposes the existence of a bond between two parties, giving each a claim on the other. And thus when God says that he is very jealous for his people and for Jerusalem, God has a peculiar interest in his people and in his chosen city, is what it is intended to convey. And look again at verse 15, the bit we read a little earlier on, where God says about the heathen being at ease, I was but a little displeased, and they helped forward the affliction. And here again we have a familiar idea which is used elsewhere in the Old Testament, of the indignation of God being something which is executed by the nations of the world around, but they go beyond God's indignation and seek to raise themselves up above a level which God intended them to do. The idea is familiar in the case of the prophet Isaiah with the Assyrians, where the Assyrian planned the extermination of those whom God commissioned only to chastise. And the Babylonians too treated the Jews with such a cruelty that they are said to have paid double the divinely prescribed remedy. And Zechariah repeats this accusation. They have helped forward the affliction of God's people. And then in verse 16, God says, I am returned to Jerusalem with mercies. My house shall be built in it, saith the Lord of hosts, and a line shall be stretched forth upon Jerusalem. Cry yet, saying, thus saith the Lord of hosts, my cities through prosperity shall yet be spread abroad, and the Lord shall yet comfort Zion, and shall yet choose Jerusalem. God's favor has been caused to rest upon this city. God has chosen this place as his, and material blessings will flow from the presence of Yahweh in Jerusalem. God has not forsaken his people. He has not forgotten them. Though it be 85 years since the city was first captured, God's interest has not waned. His will be done, and then blessings will flow from the Lord in Zion, who will spread abroad throughout the earth. And now we come to the second vision, which we have in this first chapter, and verse 18 to 21. We'll read the verses this time. Then lifted I up mine eyes, and saw, and behold, four horns. And I said unto the angel that talked with me, What be these? And he answered me, These are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And the Lord showed me four carpenters. Then said I, What can these to do? And he spake, saying, These are the horns which have scattered Judah, so that no man did lift up his head, but these are come to fray them, to cast them out, the horns of the Gentiles, which lifted up their horn over the land of Judah to scatter it. Now this vision is attached very closely to the first one. And here he sees four horns and four workmen, carpenters or smiths, as the Revised Version would render it, who are there to destroy them. And the whole vision surely gives us the process by which the promise of the first vision is to be fulfilled. Now to the Hebrews, the ox, like the lion, was the symbol of strength. And the horns, as the symbol of the aggressive power of the ox, are naturally the feature that is emphasized. Amos, for instance, represents Israel as boasting of having taken to themselves horns because of some success that they had won. Zedekiah, the son of Kenana, wore a pair of horns in an acted tableau when he wanted to picture the triumph of Israel and Judah over the Syrians. We know that in this case he acted as a false prophet. It's one that is familiar in the book of Daniel, of course. Now, the horns here certainly represent foreign nations. But having said that, there the agreement ends, and there the controversy begins. For some have said that these four horns represent only one power, the power of Babylon, and there are four of them to represent the four winds to show the universal extent, or rather not the universal, but the widespread extent of the Babylonian Empire in the ancient world. So far as they were concerned, it could well be called a universal spread of the Babylonian Empire. But others have held that the four horns represent four quite distinct empires. But having said that, they promptly fall out about which they mean. And you have one problem in verse 19. These are the horns which have scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. And a number of writers have argued that because the word Israel is used here, we must include the Assyrians as the great power that smote the northern kingdoms in 721 and carried them away captive too. And so they would list the four horns as being Assyria, Babylon, Medo-Persia, and Greece. Or, if we regard the word Israel as something which is to be combined with Judah, because if you read the book of Chronicles carefully, we find that there was a steady flow of people from the northern kingdom to the south in search of the true religion and the pure worship of the Lord that was still centered in Judah and in Jerusalem. There was a steady flow of people south, as if you apply these words to them in a general sense, then the four empires could be Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. But yet other writers would argue that the horns represent Israel's enemies on all sides. Now the four carpenters or smiths are men who are skillful to build, but they're also skillful to destroy. Now are they four empires too? And again, there's a wide variety of point of view. And some have said that they are definite empires of the ancient world, and some have made the most complicated picture out of this vision, in which the first carpenter destroys the first horn, and then himself becomes the second horn, which is destroyed by the second carpenter who becomes the third horn, which is destroyed by the third carpenter who becomes the fourth horn, and the fourth carpenter goes on the retired list. Or something like that, anyway. My own opinion, for what it is worth, is that the horns here represent the Babylonians and other nations aiding and abetting them that led to the destruction of the temple and the captivity of Jerusalem. For we can easily overlook the fact that though Babylon were the great military power that did the actual conquering, there were smaller nations around Israel who were very pleased to see it done, who were glad to help in any way that they could to the hastening of judgment upon the hated Israelites, the traditional enemies of Israel around their borders. It may well be, then, that the four horns simply represent the Babylonians and other nations, leading to the destruction of the temple and the captivity of Judah. Now, the four carpenters, what are they? Well, let's look at chapter 6 and verse 5. The angel answered and said unto me, "These are the four spirits of the heavens, which go forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth." Might not then the four carpenters and the four spirits be simply the same way of speaking of the supernatural means through which God accomplishes his purpose? Now, on this view of the carpenters, the horns could conceivably be four successive empires, but their work seems localized to what has been the comparatively recent period of the captivity. There is one point of view that is sufficiently respectable to be put forward, however, which sees the horns and the carpenters as being empires. On this view, the first horn is the Babylonian Empire, destroyed by the first carpenter, which is represented as the Medo-Persians, who then become the second horn, destroyed by the second carpenter, who are the Greeks, who in turn become the third horn, destroyed by the third carpenter, which is Rome, and then becomes the fourth horn, which is destroyed by the fourth carpenter, which it is argued is Christ. Now, this interpretation may be possible, but I honestly don't feel that it is probable. It seems to slip too easily from the idea of imperial Rome to papal Rome, and depends upon an interpretation of Daniel 7, that is to say the least of it, exceedingly doubtful. It also slips too easily from wicked nations as carpenters to our Lord Jesus. We would not expect such an utter silence about the work of the fourth carpenter if indeed we are to see here a picture of Jesus ushering in the coming of the kingdom of God. And I certainly think that we are quite safe in radically excising these particular horns. And now the third vision, the man with the measuring line, chapter 2 and beginning at verse 1. I lifted up mine eyes again and looked, and behold, a man with a measuring line in his hand. Then said I, "Whither goest thou?" And he said unto me, "To measure Jerusalem, to see what is the breadth thereof, and what is the length thereof." And behold, the angel that talked with me went forth, and another angel went out to meet him, and said unto him, "Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle therein. For I, saith the Lord, will be unto her a wall of fire round about, and will be the glory in the midst of her." Now, who are the characters, first of all? Well, there's the man with the measuring line, there's the interpreter angel who talks to Zechariah, and there's another angel. But who is the young man of verse 4? "Run, speak to this young man," saying so on and so forth. Who is he? Well, some have concluded that this young man could be no other than Zechariah, and have on this basis argued quite extensively about the character of Zechariah being such a youthful man to whom was committed such a great trust, and so on and so forth. I don't think this is the case at all. It seems to me much more likely that the young man after whom the other angel is to run is the man already spoken of as having gone out with a measuring line in his hand to measure the dimensions of Jerusalem. Now, surely, the man who has gone out to measure Jerusalem is the one who is intended here. For he represents the party who would limit the growth of Jerusalem. He is the man who sees only the national restoration of the people of Israel. This represents the conservative party in Judaism. For surely what Zechariah intends to convey is that there is a deeper message than the mere restoration of a city that was knocked down and the rebuilding of a temple which they hoped that God would inhabit. There is a deeper message. Jerusalem is to be built on bigger lines than this. It is to be on a bigger scale than ever men dreamed of. It is to be an international spiritual city containing God's glory, and his presence would be a wall of fire around it. Surely here there's some anticipation of the marvelous vision of the book of Revelation, where he sees the new Jerusalem coming down from heaven as a bride adorned for her husband. Here is a much larger conception of the restoration. Run after this young man. Tell him his measurements are inadequate. His measuring line won't do. This isn't the breadth and the length of the Jerusalem that God will establish. It's something greater than this. I think it's a wonderful message, and I'm fairly happy about that interpretation of it. Now, in verse 6 and onwards, there's a message of exhortation which Zechariah addresses to those who are still in exile. Ho, ho, he cries, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord. For I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heaven, saith the Lord. Deliver thyself, O Zion, that dwellest with the daughter of Babylon. For thus saith the Lord of hosts, after the glory hath he sent me unto the nations which spoiled you. For he that toucheth you toucheth the apple of his eye. For behold, I will shake mine hand upon them, and they shall be a spoil to their servants, and ye shall know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me. And so the passage goes on to speak of the glory of the future, of many nations being joined to the Lord, and God dwelling in the midst of his people. And then shall the people know that the Lord of hosts hath sent me unto Judah his portion in the Holy Land, and shall choose Jerusalem again. Be silent, O all flesh, before the Lord, for he is raised up out of his holy habitation. And this message is addressed to those who have still not returned from captivity. For we must not suppose for a moment that the majority of the people who were carried away captive came away in the time of Ezra, Nehemiah, or of Zechariah, or Haggai, or any of the other prophets. There were still many who, having settled down in the country of exile, were perfectly comfortable, saw absolutely no reason at all why they should return, and there they intended to stay. Here there is a warning to them to come back, for God has great things in store for his land. It is still his land. And when God does these things, then all men shall know that Zechariah is his prophet. It will be the confirmation of his prophetic office. But what does he say about the north? Flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord. Now, why refer to Babylon as being in the north? Geographically, it isn't. Well, the reason is, and it's one that we must think about several times as we look through the prophecy of Zechariah, is that the invading armies of the Babylonians, as of other nations in that region, always came into the land of Palestine through the north. They obviously couldn't cross the dreadful Syrian desert. They had to, any Babylonian army that arose and wanted to come into Canaan, had to follow the path of the Fertile Crescent, had to go northwards, turning through Syria, and then come southwards into the land. In other words, so far as an inhabitant of Jerusalem was concerned, this threat came from the north. And because the threat came from the north, Babylon itself is conceived as being in the north, because from them came this military invasion that resulted in the captivity. That's the explanation of the reference to the land of the north. It's one that we must look at again as we go on. Now, moving on to just the beginning of chapter 3, the fourth vision, we have here one of the highlights of the prophecy of Zechariah, a passage much discussed amongst us, one that's been very much discussed by any who have attempted to understand this wonderful book, the vision of Joshua the high priest. We'll just look at some of the ideas in this chapter. Now, where is this vision set? Some have said it's in Jerusalem. Some have said it was right in the middle of the unfinished temple. Others have set it in the court of heaven. Well, your guess is as good as mine, but I'd venture to say that it's more likely to be in the court of heaven. For various reasons, you can look at 1 Kings 22 for yourselves in the book of Job, chapter 1 and verse 6, if you like. I'm not going to argue that point. It's not sufficiently important. Now, the word Satan here. He showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord, and Satan standing at his right hand to resist him. And the Lord said to Satan, the Lord rebuke thee, O Satan. Even the Lord that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuke thee. Is not this a brand plucked out of the fire? Now, the translators of the Bible have done us a disservice by transcribing this word Satan instead of translating it. For the word, of course, means the adversary. And perhaps in only a few more passages could it be more clearly demonstrated than in this, that it does mean simply the adversary. For the whole picture which Zechariah is conjuring up is based on a Jewish legal trial where the accused faced the judge with the pursuer standing at his right hand and acting as an adversary. The adversary's function being to recite the charges and provide the substantiation of those charges. And here he is the prosecuting counsel rather than the executioner. So reading back the ideas of the medieval church into this chapter only leads into very great confusion indeed. The picture is not of a subterranean region of boiling pitch and sulphur and all the rest of it. It's a picture of the Jewish legal trial. One illustration may come to mind. You remember the cities of refuge? A man who was guilty of manslaughter could flee to a city of refuge. The avenger of blood, or the next of kin, the redeemer, could pursue him to this city. He could bring the man to trial. The two would then face the presiding judge with the accuser standing at the accused right hand, acting as his adversary and saying, this man is not guilty of manslaughter, he's guilty of murder. And the charge was heard and the judgment was given. And that was how the trial was conducted. It's an example of Jewish legal method. And Zechariah is modelling the picture that he is showing here on this particular method of trying adversaries, or trying those who are accused, rather. Now, some have said that Joshua himself is supposed to be on trial as a person. But surely it is much more likely that he is on trial as the representative of his people. Joshua, remember, was the spiritual head and representative of his people. And he therefore stands in their place when he stands on trial in this fashion before the angel of the Lord in the very court of heaven itself, as it were. Now, before the adversary can present his brief, before he begins to recite his charges and to bring his substantiation, he is rebuked in a dramatic fashion. Whatever the charges are, God will forgive them, because God has chosen Jerusalem and regards his people as being a brand plucked out of the burning. Now, in verse 3, Joshua was clothed with filthy garments and stood before the angel. Surely this teaches us that the guilt of the nation was something which was quite obvious. The guilt of the nation and the silence of Joshua to speak in his own defense surely argue that defense was impossible and indeed unnecessary in this case. And then in verse 4, the presiding judge gives his verdict. He answered and spake unto those that stood before him, saying, take away the filthy garments from him. And unto him he said, behold, I have caused thine iniquity to pass from thee, and I will clothe thee with a change of raiment. There again, there is no question of the guilt of the accused. But in spite of the guilt of the accused, the judge is going to exercise his prerogative of mercy. He's going to cause that iniquity to pass, and has prescribed a change of raiment for the one who stands before the presiding judge. It's a triumph of mercy over justice. And the forgiveness which the nation receives is not one which is merited. It's not the result of a long, protracted argument between various counsels. It's the result of grace. It is God in his mercy, not heeding the charge that was that could have been brought, knowing well the guilt of the accused, and yet removing it, because he is a God of love and mercy and of grace. He teaches us a wonderful lesson of God's relationship to his people, of the relationship that he tried to have with them, rather, and one which they often, again and again, misconstrued in terms of privilege instead of opportunity. But that's another story. Now, in verse 5, and I said, well, was it Zechariah who said it? Some ancient authorities say, and he said. And this seems more likely, that this is a continuation of the speech of the angel of the Lord, speaking on God's behalf. He said, let them set a fair mitre upon his head. So they set a fair mitre upon his head and clothed him with garments, and the angel of the Lord stood by. Here is the restoration to favor and fellowship with God. Here is the consecration anew of the nation. Remember the picture of the book of Exodus, where Aaron is crowned with this mitre of the Lord, engraved with the words, holiness to the Lord. And having been crowned in this fashion, the lobe of his right ear, the tip of his right thumb, and his right toe are touched with blood to indicate a dedication to God, a constant readiness to hear the word of God, a constant activity in the ways of God, using all the power of one's hands in his service, a readiness to walk in his ways as he has commanded. Here is a wonderful figure of the restoration of the nation in the putting of the mitre again upon the head. And it was a restoration, too, to the priestly office. Here again we get an unmistakable hint that the nation had really been called, ideally, as a nation of priests, a kingdom of priests whom God had called for himself. And the hallmark of their consecration was the words that they wore, the high priest wore on his mitre, holiness to the Lord. Now in verse 7 there is the promise of personal reward of Joshua's loyalty, though there is much more to it than that. If thou wilt walk in my ways, if thou wilt keep my charge, then thou shalt also judge my house, and shalt also keep my courts, and I will give thee places to walk among these that stand by. Hear now Joshua the high priest, thou and all thy fellows that sit before thee, for they are men wondered at. For behold, I will bring forth my servant the branch, For behold, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, upon one stone shall be seven eyes. Behold, I will engrave the engraving thereof, saith the Lord of hosts, and I will remove the iniquity of the land in one day. In that day, saith the Lord of hosts, shall ye call every man his neighbour under the vine and under the fig tree. Now, I want to talk about the picture of the man whose name is the branch a little later. I don't want to rush it now, so at this point I want to leave that.